Okay, so I'm Rick Hansen. This is the 17th of March, 2015.
18th.
Sorry about that. And I want to try to pull together four topics. One, the third foundation of mindfulness. Two, the phenomenology of now. Three, attachment theory. And four, how to be a really great person in relationships. And I'm going to try to do that like that. Okay, so hang in there with me. We'll see if I can pull this one off. Anyway, so first, foundations of mindfulness. Arguably the fundamental path of practice and prescription for practice laid out in the teachings of the Buddha himself is summarized as the four foundations or establishments of mindfulness. And the term in Pali, the language of early Buddhism, for that is sati, patana, sati being mindfulness and patana being establishing or resting of it or what does it reside in, okay? Classically, there are four foundations of mindfulness, one being mindfulness of the body, second being mindfulness of the quality of experience as pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral, third being qualities of mind, and I'll read you the passage about that momentarily, and fourth, mindfulness of various themes, like the hindrances, or the Four Noble Truths, or the factors of awakening, etc. Okay? So, in the third foundation of mindfulness, we are to be mindful, and in particular, we are to simply be with and observe the mind in various states. And this is what the original passage said. So, and I'll rephrase it slightly as if it is directed to us or to you. So he says, and how, people, do you regard the mind, and how do you, in regard to the mind, abide contemplating the mind? Here, you know a lustful mind to be lustful, quote unquote, and a mind without lust to be without lust. You know an angry mind to be angry, and a mind without anger to be without anger. You know a deluded mind to be deluded and a mind without delusion to be without delusion. You know a composed mind to be composed and a distracted mind to be distracted. You know a great mind to be great and a narrow mind to be narrow. You know a surpassable mind to be surpassable and an unsurpassable mind to be unsurpassable. You know an unconcentrated mind to be an unconcentrated mind and a concentrated mind to be concentrated. And you know an unliberated mind to be unliberated and a liberated mind to be liberated. In this way, in regard to the mind, you abide contemplating the mind internally, externally in others, internally and externally. You abide contemplating the nature of arising, of passing away, of both arising and passing away in regard to the mind. Mindfulness that there is a mind is established in you to the extent necessary for bare knowledge and continuous mindfulness. And you abide independent, not clinging to anything in the world. That is how, in regard to the mind, you abide contemplating the mind. There's a weight, isn't there, to like these original teachings. And just for some clarity, there's some traditional words here that are umbrella terms. Lust is an umbrella term for any kind of problematic desire, for anything. Lust to be right, lust for other people to think well of us, sexual lust per se, wanting that third cookie even when you know it's not so good for you. You know, that's under the heading of lust. And let's see, where am I here? Surpassable, it's the idea that a surpassable state of mind is one in which you're in a good place, but you know there's another step. And if you think about the distinctions here, four of them have to do with ordinary states of mind, and four of them have to do with sort of non-ordinary states of mind. The ordinary states are knowing if your mind is lustful or not lustful, knowing if your mind is angry or not angry, knowing if it is deluded or not deluded, knowing if it is distracted or not distracted. That's fairly ordinary psychology. And then you have the realm of knowing if your mind is, where am I here? Knowing if your mind is narrow or great, in some elevated state, knowing if your mind is surpassable or unsurpassable, knowing if your mind is unconcentrated or concentrated, and also knowing if your mind is, you know, liberated or not liberated, okay? So we're going to focus here, on the first four that are kind of more down to earth and ordinary. Lustful, not lustful, angry, not angry, distracted, not distracted, deluded, not deluded, okay? The practice here in terms of pure mindfulness, which means only being with, so that little bit mindfulness is present, is an important way to engage the mind. Often we do that in meditation. We're just sitting there. We're not trying to change anything. But from time to time, we just have a little moment. Is there anger here? Which includes, by the way, the aversion of fear. It's essentially aversion to what's unpleasant. Am I pushing anything away? Am I resisting anything? Am I worrying about anything? Am I irritated or frustrated or exasperated about anything? Right now, we're not. You're simply aware of it. That would be mindfulness of a mind as angry or not angry, right? Or you might notice, in this moment, there's complete sense of contentment. I'm not trying to reach for anything else. I'm not planning some fantasy vacation. I'm not, you know, grinding through my, how am I going to do that email? You know, I'm just at ease. Or alternately, you might notice there is some kind of grasping, some quote unquote lust, okay? Or you might notice that in this moment, wow, am I distracted. My mind's going a million miles an hour. Maybe I should not have had that third Red Bull. I don't know. Maybe that had something to do with it, right? Or you might notice, wow, I'm boom, plop, I'm here. Or you might notice that your mind is kind of deluded. You're sort of caught up in ideas or views about things that are just off, presumptions, assumptions. Or you might notice, oh, there's a lot of clarity here. See, we're aware of that. So that's kind of the pure form of just being with. That's the essence of this practice, a powerful kind of being with. In addition to that, though, it's important to make wise efforts and to plant seeds over time that grow wholesome qualities, such as a mind that is not lustful, not angry, or to put it a little differently, a mind that is contented instead of lustful, peaceful instead of angry, a mind that is clear rather than deluded, a mind that is really settled rather than distracted. Okay? We can grow those qualities in ourselves, and we can gradually over time release through wise effort their opposites. Okay? How do we actually do that? And that takes us to my second topic, the phenomenology of now. And what I mean by that fancy phrase is that I think the essence of Buddhism, you could argue the essence of any wisdom tradition, is a grappling with this fundamental tension or contradiction between what life needs to do and to be life, and the nature of reality. You know, for example, life is continually trying to stabilize things. Hold on to this position, keep it like this if it's okay, stabilize the absence of the bad if it's here. And in terms of just pure, you know, the flow of experience, you know, we're always trying to stabilize the mind, the nervous system is continually trying to stabilize its representations. Banana, stabilized. You know, you, stabilized. My thought about something or other, stabilized. Okay? The problem is those powerful needs of any organism for stability, as well as a variety of other things, but I'm going to focus on stability here, run smack dab in the face of maybe one of the most extraordinary things of all that's continually under our nose, which is the endlessness of impermanence, right? The bizarreness that as soon as you're aware of anything, it's gone. At this moment of reality, as soon as it exists, it no longer exists, right? We live in this incredibly narrow, temporally, infinitely thin slice, as far as we know, right? That somehow contains everything. Completely bizarre. And experientially, there's this ongoing sense of as experience just falls away and disappears, right? And it's a little bit as if we are at the apex of a standing wave. You know, like imagine a river flowing over a boulder, kicking up a standing wave, right? The wave itself is relatively stable, but the molecules of the water and the moment-to-moment shape or patterning of that wave is continually changing. So a lot of what I think deep practice is to increasingly face the reality of experience, to come into the immediacy of the disappearing of experiencing and face it, while at the same time finding a way to be increasingly peaceful about that, to find the stability of instability, to find security in insecurity, in a sense. How do we actually do that? And that's where I want to talk about now my third topic, attachment theory. And it's the idea that if a person in their, you know, early history as a child, all the way through, you know, the teen years, or events in adulthood, if we as the most profoundly socially dependent animals on the planet, you know, whose primary adaptations over the last several million years have been to living with others, have been about living with others and to live with others more successfully. That's our primary adaptation. More than standing upright, more than, you know, color vision and all the rest of that, more than being able to, you know, throw rocks at moving targets. It's learning how to live with other people and survive as a band which passed on his genes and helped those genes pass on genes. Right? So in that context, we have deep needs to feel secure in our relationships with others. And if we don't, the residues stay with us and make us very unsettled at the apex, at the tippity-tip top of that standing wave, especially interpersonally, when you think of the standing wave of being with other people, including being with other people in our mind, interacting with our inner audience, the imagined others. We often are thinking about, predicting how they'll act, if we do X or Y, how they'll feel about this, how I can get over with you if I do that. You know, I'm seeing a guy right now who's just starting to go out in the dating world after coming out of his divorce, and, you know, all his predictions about others and their predictions about him, that whole world, you know. We're in that world a lot of relationships with others, right? That's a lot of the water moving through this instant of the standing wave. If we have residues inside of insecurity, it tends to drive us toward lust, broadly defined as chasing after what might be or is pleasant, right? Interpersonally, we're uneasy. We're always trying to hold on to or get more of that good relational stuff. Or if we have these residues inside, and most of us do, me included, right? Very few people have an entirely benign childhood or entirely benign relational experiences that don't leave impacts, right? So because of those impacts as well, we tip easily into anger, you know, being frustrated or afraid, you know, resisting what's unpleasant. Also, we tend to be deluded, right? We're fantasizing about this, often overestimating the bad coming at us or underestimating the good that could be, or just otherwise getting confused, or we get kind of distracted, right? Those four aspects of mindfulness of mind, you know, the third foundation, right? We kind of get distracted. Our mind's wandering all over the place. So what do we do about it? One thing we could do about it is to really look for opportunities to internalize today, here and now, four key experiences based on attachment that often were not entirely delivered to us appropriately as kids or later on in life, or there was not just the absence of the good in these four areas, but the presence of the bad, issues, wounds, shamings, mistreatment, something, abuse even, things happen. Okay, what are the four? One is emotional availability. Think of it as kind of moving up the ladder here with these four. Rung one is the other emotionally available? Do you have the experience that the other is present for you? You have their attention. And it's not just a superficial attending, but you have access to their innards. It's one of the fundamental things that parents and other caregivers need to give children, especially young children, is a sense of emotional availability. One of the issues these days that many people are talking about is how parents are so absorbed in their electronic devices. Their attention is not available to the kids. I had a friend, a consultant, who placed a lot of kids in boarding schools, you know, who typically would come from fairly well-to-do families. He said very often in those families, you know, parents would give their kids anything except their time, which really means except their attention or access. So emotional availability. So it's very important to get a sense of others as emotionally available when they are in the ways that they are. It may well be imperfect, but at least that slice of the relational pie is authentic and real. They are actually emotionally available. So you have opportunities for that experience. Whew! Value them. It's part of your own path to awakening, to value those experiences, not trivialize them, and open to them and let your longings be your guide for them. Okay? Second key experience is not just emotional availability, but attuned responsiveness. That people are empathizing with you, they're reading your wants accurately, and they're being skillfully responsive. For example, I just was working with a couple the other day, and I could see that what was happening was that each of them was making tacit, implicit, sort of veiled, you know, requests. But the other person was not surfacing the request, naming it, being explicit about it, and then responding to it one way or another, including just saying no, for example. Although they each did want to say yes to the request, but without the request being clear, you know, there's no way for the other to be that attuned and responsive, okay? So when you do have opportunities, when we have opportunities to recognize attuned responsiveness in the other, that's an important relational supply to take into ourselves, in part to reduce our craving and clinging, right, at the apex of the standing wave. We lighten up at the apex of the standing wave. We get looser and easier as we internalize again and again and again the felt sense of others, in this case, being attuned and responsive. Right? Third, moving up the ladder again, is that in addition to the other being emotionally available and attuned and responsive, it's that they value us. Kids need to not just feel that their parents, for example, are emotionally available, or also, in addition to being emotionally available, attuned and responsive, they need to feel special. We need to feel that people see the good in us. You know, they see the value, they see the good intentions, even if the outcome is bad, right? In terms of knocking the glass over the table, off the table. Kids need to feel, and adults need to feel, that others see our good qualities, you know, our abilities, our efforts, our kindnesses, our sincerity, and our weird, cute, funny foibles. But they see the cool stuff about us, right? So when others give you that experience, right, whether it's your dog or your mate, or whatever else, that they see what's good about you. They respect you. They appreciate you. They're grateful to your contribution. They see your abilities. They see the good in you, right? That is a really important experience to take in, okay? Especially to the extent it's available in just everyday life. And then fourth, it's that in addition to the other being emotionally available and attuned responsive, and valuing, prizing. In addition to that, they're loyal to you. They seek you. They want you. They pursue you. They keep their agreements with you. They care about their impact on you. There's a kind of loyalty there. It's not a blind loyalty necessarily, but they're going to show up for you You know, they're going to help you move. They're going to care about something that happened where they had some kind of inadvertent negative impact on you. They're going to stick up for you with other people, right? They're going to deliver the goods. They're going to come through in those ways, right? So when we have that opportunity in everyday life to experience that someone is reliable, they're loyal, they're on your side, they're for you, they're an ally, that too is a really important experience to take in. And in the taking in of it, it relaxes us at the top of that standing wave, you know, so we don't hold on so much anymore. We don't need to hold on because we've already got the goods more and more inside ourselves. Which then brings me to my fourth topic, how to be an awesome person in relationships. It's essentially to think about delivering those four things to other people, as it is authentic for you. To think about being emotionally available to others rather than have what someone coined the term from Silicon Valley, continuously divided attention. But to actually give someone your wholly present attention for 5 seconds in a row, 10 or 20 or 30. That's usually, most people are fine with that. Like they're blowing their, you're blowing their mind, you know, like a dozen seconds in a row of sustained, wholehearted, you know, open-faced attention. Wow, right? So giving others emotional availability, access to it. One thing that helps to do that, of course, is to remember that we're not waiving our rights. It's okay to have appropriate boundaries. We're not going to let them suck us dry. They usually don't want to anyway. They don't want to kill the goose that's laying the golden eggs. Right? Also, look for opportunities to really read people accurately, to tune into them, to track the request that's actually implicit or embedded in what they're saying because they're kind of nervous about being really overt about it. Or what are they really feeling beneath the surface? You know, superficially, oh, I'm fine, just fine, just fine, right? But what's underneath that, you know? And then how can we respond to that? One of the most powerful ways to be at peace with others is to take maximum reasonable personal responsibility for delivering the goods in terms of their legitimate wants from you and complaints and grievances. Wow. Right? Or look for opportunities, of course, to prize others, to really see the good in others, not flattery. Flattery, I think, is the near enemy of real prizing. Right? It's not flattery, but it's real recognition, it's real appreciation, it's real extending ourselves for that. And then last, of course, to look at how loyal, how honorable we are, how much we actually show up, you know, for other people who count on us and deliver the goods, you know, when you can. And as we do that, just to finish on that point and then see what you think, it's really interesting as we, you know, be awesome to others. It's like, what is that Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure? What? Be good to each other and party on or something like that. What's the line? Help me here. Or something like that. Be excellent. Be excellent. Not good. Be excellent to each other and party on. Anyway. Okay. Pretty good way to be, yeah? So as we do that, suddenly the world starts shifting for us and we get more and more comfortable hanging out and, you know, as the standing wave, right, as this moment, you know, continually letting go and being continually fed by reality altogether, including our relationships with other people. Okay. What do you think about all that?
He had the five A's, and a couple of those tie straight into what you're saying. It's first of all, attention, which is one of the sweetest, most loving things you can do.
Yeah.
Acceptance, appreciation, appropriate affection, and then allowing. Mm. And so for me, I'm tying into attention and appreciation.
Yeah.
For me, those are the two major ones.
That's great. And thank you for saying that, including flagging, you know, there's a lot here in any kind of presentation or anything. You know, what's high impact for you personally? If there's a word or a particular takeaway, what's that takeaway for you to really be a theme in practice for you today, tonight, maybe this week? And that's really good to do, You know, not trying to remember everything or do everything, but a couple of them. What's that takeaway? Okay, that's great. Yeah, please.
It's so funny because sometimes I feel like I've been practicing something that you talked about in class just before you. And one of the things was in our entire class, we've been talking about the third foundation of mindfulness.
Oh, I didn't know that. Oh, cool.
Well, I've been talking.
Yeah.
It's like I'm obsessed by it right now. But the other thing, too, is that lately when I do my meta practice, I've been thinking about my parents who have both passed away. And during my portion of meta practice, I think about the last time that I hugged them, what it felt like to be appreciated by my parents as part of my loving kindness towards myself. And it really fed into what you were talking about as far as getting that feedback from your parents when you're young. So I feel like I'm on the right track again.
Oh, great. Good for you.
Yeah.
Great. Yeah.
Speaking to emotional availability, my partner of 10 years said to me the other day in an intimate moment, she said, you know, there are things about me or what I think that I have never told anybody. And I want to tell you some of those things. So can we, you know, make time out to start doing that? And are you willing to tell me some of the things that you have never told anybody that are a part of the fabric of you? And it was just, when you were talking about emotional availability, and here, of course, I'm talking about intimate partnerships. It hit me. I mean, wow, that's a big deal.
Yeah.
And what is it for me that I'm still not disclosing to somebody that I love and care about?
Yeah. Well, thank you, Tom, for saying all that.
You have any tips?
I'm just appreciating you. Notice you're being appreciated, you know. Seriously.
I have a tip for you, Tom. And because I can relate, I've been in a relationship for 35 years. And it's like a matter of layers that you're peeling. And no, nobody ever really knows you like you do. And the fact that they can continue to find out things about you is good. And that it can keep lasting for a very long time is good. And so just let it happen. And don't worry about it. You're not going to find the final answer, or you're not going to be completely known. Because you don't even completely know yourself. I don't know myself. And so it's a learning process, continuously.
Thank you for that.
Yeah. And to the gentleman in the room, what's so frightening about transparency? If you're not transparent, then you're not you. Correct or incorrect? I mean, somebody should like you, whether could like you, whether or not you think bad or not of yourself. None of us are perfect. So that's kind of shallow, not shallow, but I don't see what's most frightening about, you know, somebody thinking, I don't think they're going to be with you for 10 years if they think like that. Just my thoughts, I don't know.
Yeah, thank you. Well, I think that one of the scariest things is to be really revealed, just in general, right? And, you know, speaking of films, I don't know if you've seen the film Almost Famous. You know, it's really sweet. Cameron Crowe did it. There's this great line in it where basically this crusty character is telling this young boy who's the protagonist, the future Cameron Crowe, who's trying to be cool amidst all these rock stars. The main character, this character, Philip Seymour Hoffman, when he was alive, says to the teenage boy, the only real currency in this world is what we say to each other when we're not trying to be cool or when we're not being cool. All right, isn't that a beautiful line? And I think that's what you're talking about. I think we get so honored when someone is willing to be open with us. And it's a beautiful gift from them that they're willing to do that. It's kind of sacred, I think. And it calls us to be that ourselves. And, you know, as you were saying in the back there, I find that I think there's a place for privacy, you know, I think. But I also think that internally we often have a sense of needing to defend or hide certain things. A definition of shame, one definition of shame is something is revealed that ought to be hidden. And that's in the frame a lot of toilet training and Freudian psychoanalysis and stuff like that. But there's an interesting idea that we tend to be ashamed about what's revealed, right? We get embarrassed about things, you know. And if you think about, again, what makes us cling at the top of the wave? That's what I'm zeroed in on. The third foundation of mindfulness. Mindfulness of clinging or not clinging. Now, forever. What makes us cling there? What are the causes of clinging? Or in the causes of letting go at the top of your personal wave of now and now and now? And one of those forms of clinging has to do with hiding things, right? Or maneuvering so that certain things are not revealed, right? How we feel, what we long for, how we got hurt, how we feel less than others, how we would love to go to bed with you, or whatever that is, you know. And I'm not saying it's appropriate to reveal everything always, okay? There's kind of a so-called curvilinear relationship between self-disclosure and mental health. Low self-disclosure is associated with low mental health as a general thing. Incredibly high self-disclosure, blah, 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 is associated with low mental health. But kind of like moderate self-disclosure is associated with moderate mental health. So you find your sweet spot. Of course, obviously, that's a lot based on culture and situation and stuff like that. But you might, again, ask yourself, what would be such a big deal, going to Tom's point and your point in the back there, if it were to be revealed, really? And myself, okay, I will tell you this story. So just imagine. So I'm going to... I don't think I've ever told you this. Okay, so there I was like 21, 23 maybe. And growing up, I was very young going through school and kind of late to puberty. So I wasn't terribly confident about myself physically. And then I found myself one sunny Los Angeles afternoon on the edge of a pool in the backyard of a house with high fences with a dozen other people doing a body awareness and massage class. It's me like 1976, so place it in the time. And the beginning was, we were all gonna, the dozen of us, introduce ourselves, our body. We're gonna introduce our body to the group. Already I was starting to panic. But you know, I was dedicated to personal growth. I was gonna do it, I was in there, and of course I wanted to hide that I was panicking and embarrassed, and I had all these insecurities and everything else. So, and you can just imagine yourself, there you are in that setting. So, first, I think I'm number three or four in the sequence. The first person goes up and says, yeah, this is my body, and it's, you know, what I think about these different parts. And they created a safe setting there, you know, okay, fine. Second person pulls off, I think it was a guy, pulls off his shirt and said, this is my body, and instantly I'm going, fuck. This is not looking good. It's already freaking me out. It says a shirt off, you know? Plus, I should also tell you, I grew up in a home for two different kinds of reasons. My parents were both really pretty uptight, period, including about the body, sexuality, the whole thing, okay? So that's number two. Number third person I remember now is a woman next to me, and she goes, okay, and she takes it down to her underwear. She's wearing underwear. I am really starting to lose it. I'm like 23, 24. Oh my God. I was so embarrassed, you know. Like, oh my God. You know, but I'm trying to be cool, you know. I do this all the time. Grew up in a nudist colony. Yeah. No, we're not. You know, no worries, right? So then it comes to me, and it's that moment of truth. Probably a lot of us have had the moment of truth. This is a very physical and graphic moment of concrete moment of truth, but there are other moments of truth, right? Where we tell someone we love them and we don't know if they're going to say it back, right? Or we tell someone we don't love them you know, but they love us, and then what do you do? Whatever it is, okay? Sorry, long story short, it comes to me, and I stood up, and I had this moment of truth. And what ripped, so I just went for it. I just peeled off my shirt, peeled off my pants, and just took it all off. And in that moment, I was like plugged into an electrical socket. You know, of course, I didn't display any of that. It was so cool. But, and then ripped through me like in about 4 to 10 seconds, like 23 years of shame and embarrassment about my body and fear of revealing it. And then, kaboom, here's the body, whatever. And then it kind of grounded out, you know. So that's an example of, you know, breaking through a fair amount of fear about revealing yourself, and yet on the other side of it, a kind of freedom, et cetera, et cetera. That's a very dramatic example. I'm not recommending you all do it right now. Please, that would be too weird. Okay, but I'm just saying that, you know, it speaks to a larger thing. Okay, I should move to a wrap here.
No,
too.
You can't stop the
story. Oh, that's where it ends? Oh, the next person there.
No.
No, what do you mean, for myself? No, all right, that's what it was. And then everybody else took off their clothes, pretty much. You know, except for maybe one or two people just down to their underwear. But it was like a standard had been set. But it was really interesting, like the fear, and then you think, oh, well, revealed, whatever. Or revealed, I love you and you don't love me. Awkward, but okay. I mean, it's not going to kill us. Or, yeah, you did that and I really got mad. Revealed. Or, I kind of worry if you like me as much as I like you. Oh, well, revealed, you know. Or, yeah, you're right, I didn't give you my full attention. I acted like I was doing it because we're in this therapy thing together here, but really, I wasn't. But I'm going to cop to it and move on. You know, it's kind of like Buddhism and spiritual practice altogether is about freedom. You know, the quotation from, I think, Upandita, great teacher of Southeast Asia's purpose of practice is to expand the range of experiences in which we're free. Can I be free, stripped naked, standing in front of a bunch of people with their clothes on? That's really weird. Just going, here it is. You know? Like, can we be free in those moments? Can we be free being seen? Can we be free being revealed as not really having paid attention? And also wanting to have a second chance, right? So, anyway. Just to kind of summarize and finish up, think quick little review. Number one, tracking states of mind. That's the third foundation of mindfulness, and which really boils down to more or less craving in the moment, in the mind. And then starting to track causes, okay? And then two, really being aware of, here you are in the standing wave of now, what lets you relax into it, feeling continually buoyed by the next arising, even as it disappears? What helps? And one thing that can really help, third, has to do with our profoundly social nature and the internalization again and again and again of core necessary human relational supplies. It's like, yeah, you could probably live if you don't get enough vitamin C, but something's always missing. It's important to get those supplies of feeling others are emotionally available, they're attuned and responsive, they prize and value us, and they're loyal to us, when that's actually the case. And then fourth, of course, delivering it to others for its own sake. And because it magically, mysteriously, wonderfully, starts creating a kind of circle or cycle in which by supporting others and helping them be more relaxed, you know, at the apex of the standing wave, we get more and more relaxed and at peace and secure and free ourselves right there at the tippity top. How about we sit for a minute? At the tip of the wave. Ajahn Chah, a teacher of Jack Kornfield and others, had a lovely saying. He said, if you let go a little, you'll have a little happiness. If you let go a lot, you'll have a lot of happiness. And if you let go completely, you'll be completely happy. And the question is, what supports that kind of letting go? That's the exploration here tonight. So, bows to you. Good night. Thank you. Okay.